Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You've still got a bit of me taking cakes into work.
We did get another section of your life, Howard. I feel like we need a TV series of just your life, Howard. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Bakedown Podcast. We are doing our season 4 throwback and we are on episode 4, so we're motoring through nicely. With me today, as always, we have the lovely Jane, Dan and Howard, and we are going to be looking at episode 4, which is Pies and Tarts Week. Now, this is something I don't think we see a lot of. We see pies and tarts scattered throughout the competition, but to have a dedicated Pies and Tarts Week, it's not that common, is it?
I don't think so. I think normally it gets kind of absorbed into pastry week, doesn't it? But we had both a pies and tarts week and a pastry week in...
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
All the pastry. Now, Howard, every week, obviously, we ask you to watch back an episode of your season. How did you feel about watching this episode back?
Bit of a mixed bag, actually. So I thought, oh, I hated that signature bake. I did. I tried so hard in practice to sort this out. Even resorted to trying for the first time a Mary Berry recipe for a double custard fruit tart. I couldn't get that to work either. So I thought, this is awful. But yeah, I persevered. You sort of hear people in, you know, the kind of evening before when you're chatting to people about what's coming up in the next day, and you hear them about how they've managed to get solid fruit and so on as you slice through it, and you think, don't think I have. And it was such a relief watching this back, thinking, yeah, you lied, didn't you? You not managed it. You didn't manage it at all.
I mean, Howard, we were just talking about it before we started recording, but What did the brief say that the pie had to be, or that a slice had to be?
So it had to be, I think it was, I should have dug this out, but I think it had to be a double crusted pie. It couldn't be blind baked, so you had to bake it with both the bottom.
Whoa. Yeah. You couldn't blind bake it?
No. So you had to bake it, with the fruit intact, and as you, this was the other thing that blew my mind, was that the time allocated included cooling time. And you think, so I've got to cool this down and try and get it out. I didn't even bother taking mine out of the tin. I think several people did the same. But double crusted. And as you cut into it, it had to stay intact and show fruit without any leakage of fruit juice.
In 2 hours is just a joke.
That's ridiculous.
That's one of the most ridiculous time restraints, I think. I mean, they're pretty good on those, aren't they? But this surpasses all the others. 2 hours for that is just a joke. Because a decent pie, you're probably talking 45, 50 minutes to get the pastry cooked on the bottom and the top.
Yeah. that blows my mind that you couldn't. I mean, looking at the time constraints, I get that you couldn't blind bake it, actually.
Yeah.
But why would you not blind? What? I've never. Right. Okay. So I'll go on a mini rant here. So in America, I know we have lots of American listeners, like double crusted pies are a real big thing. Okay. And I know you guys make them all the time. In England, we don't really do it that much. We do have apple pie. The phrase is as American as apple pie. I think it's actually an English recipe. I'm 99% sure it's an English recipe, but or definitely European. It's definitely not American. But anyway.
We will get letters, you know.
I know we will. But I blind bake. If I do a double crusted pie, I always blind bake it. I can't imagine how that could possibly work out if you were doing it in one bake. And now that makes so much sense where everyone was putting semolina in the bottom and weird things. And I was going to get onto how I might get the fruit to set in a minute, but I just do not understand how that base could possibly have been dry.
But semolina really works, actually, because I do occasionally make double crust pie, and semolina does work, or as do ground almonds if you haven't got a nut allergy. It's just something to mop up any additional liquid. It really, really does work to do that. The problem is with this as well, I mean, you do have to cool all that fruit filling before you put it in a raw pastry base. Because you cannot put a hot filling or a warm filling into a raw pastry base. You could get away with it with a blind bake pie, but you can't with a raw bottom.
No, it'll melt all the butter.
It melts everything and then it'll go, and then it'll never go crispy then. So I think it's a really, really tough challenge for them in the 2 hours.
Yeah, I think that's really quite unreasonable, actually. I'm actually amazed. Most people struggled, but I'm amazed that anyone did a good job, actually, because I think that time constraint and the brief is, I mean, a little bit ridiculous, I've got to be honest.
I mean, I must admit, I tried some awesome, disgusting things in practice. I remember sending some recipe ideas through to my sister, and she said, apple pie with egg in it. That sounds nice. Because I tried one recipe where you coat the apple in egg in order to kind of bind it together. And that's like,
oh no.
I know, Howard, yeah, no.
That didn't make it into the final cut.
So you can see why Glenn put custard in his, to try and do the same sort of thing. I mean, I think if you look at some of the American recipes, you know, cherry pie and things like that, there's quite a lot of corn flour goes in, quite a lot of corn flour. Or you could try some arrowroot as well. Not too much arrowroot, but arrowroot can give you you can get a bit too much aftertaste. Does anybody use arrowroot? We used to use arrowroot. My dad used to use arrowroot for thickening sort of fruit glazes and things. It goes a bit plasticky sometimes if you're not too careful, and you can get an aftertaste, but it's quite useful, especially if you want to be, you don't want corn flour in there.
Yeah, arrowroot can be very gluey.
It can be a bit gluey.
It goes a little bit snotty. But so when it comes to thickening the fruit sauce, you've got a bunch of different options, and I'm going to just run through them very quickly. So you've got corn flour, which obviously works very well, but that clouds the fruit juice and makes it sort of look a little bit less appetizing. You can use tapioca, which gives you a clearer appearance, but it also gives it like little spots. Some people swear by using potato starch, again, a little bit cloudy. One thing you can get in America that for some reason you cannot get here, you can get shipped over, but it's horrifically expensive. You get something called clear gel, which needs to be cooked, and instant clear gel, which are sort of products that are made with tapioca and or heat-treated corn flour or something. I don't know. It's some kind of wizardry. And they will help it sort of gel up and be nice and clear. So the fruit juices are clear. But that's quite a specialist product, and I'm not surprised that nobody used that. But you have a few options to thicken it. But again, even if it's not completely cool, I don't know how well you'd be able to cut it. I think they were a bit set up for failure. And to be completely honest, if I'd been in that challenge, my pie would have looked like Christine's. It would have been soggy and dripping. I don't know how I would have done anything else in the time.
How anybody think of using agar? Agar? They're so good they named it twice.
Like a jelly-y.
I wonder whether that would thicken it. Or even some xanthan gum. I just use corn flour, to be honest. I mean, I'm not going to look at a piece of yummy pie and go, ooh, that fruit juice looks a bit cloudy.
If it's a dark coloured fruit, then it's absolutely fine. But if it's a light coloured fruit, like, for example, on a cherry pie, it looks much more attractive if it's a clearer.
If it's a clearer one.
Yeah.
Sorry, going to the pastry, though. Could you have done a lattice top?
I would have no time.
I don't know, actually.
Oh, yes, you have. It's easy.
Where would you have done it?
It's easy to put a lattice top on. Goodness me.
So clearly, we all have very strong feelings about our signature challenge. Yes, I mean, that is a lot to fit into such a short challenge. A criticism of Bake Off nowadays is that, especially in the last few seasons, is that the time constraints have been very strict. But this appears to have been running through the seasons all the way from the beginning. So yes, this was our double crusted fruit pie, which I only found out yesterday that means pastry top and bottom. I didn't know what the double crusted meant. And yes, the aim was no soggy bottoms. And as we've said, 2 hours to do it in. We've mentioned Christine's, sound beautiful, apple, plum and cinnamon pie. And she definitely had a soggy bottom and a soggy top. Bless her. As I said, I think any of us that would have done it within the 2 hours would have had similar problems. Yes, Glenn's custard was definitely a nice idea to help sort of bind everything together. Unfortunately, that didn't quite have the desired effect, did it? Custard didn't seem to taste of what he was aiming for.
The idea was a good idea, but it's just one of those ones that you actually can't quite execute as you planned. Because, you know, if you're going to cook the apples enough, you're going to end up with a very rubbery, overcooked custard. So it just sort of, it's, in theory, it's a great idea, but in practice, I just don't think it works. But then if you'd have been able to cook the apples first, maybe it would have been okay. But as Howard said, there was no time to be cooking the fruit, or you weren't allowed to cook the fruit. Was that it?
I think you could cook the fruit. I took the view that actually, because of the time constraint, I just used the dessert apple and cut it very fine, because I thought I'd rather have it baked longer in the oven and to cook the fruit that way than be spending time cooking it and then you'd struggle with the cooling time as well.
Yeah, because when I make an apple pie, I typically cook the apple first. I sort of make a caramel sauce, cook the apple in it, and then get some of the liquid out of the apples that way. But that takes ages. That takes about an hour to cook them, to get all the liquid out of them first. So that would not be an option.
And then, as we've mentioned, you've got to cool that filling for this challenge so it doesn't melt the pastry. So you've got a lot of things to think about. So I can definitely understand why putting the fruit in raw might have been an option for this challenge.
Yeah, Howard, can I ask a question? Sorry if this is a little offensive, but why was your pastry so crumbly? What happened?
Oh, I don't know. Again, it was that kind of belt and braces thing where I'd put polenta actually in the pastry as well. And I just think it was the fear of kind of overworking it and so on. It just needed more liquid in it, really.
Okay, yeah, I wondered why it was so crumbly. I just couldn't figure it out.
We would say that in a class, wouldn't we? We get people saying, oh, this is not coming together, this is not coming together, especially when maybe ingredients and quantities have travelled across the pond. It's very often our friends in the US that have problems with our recipes and crumbly pastry. And I always say, just add some water, just add some water to bring it together. But your brain disappears when you're in a hurry in the tent sometimes.
Oh, I know. Yes.
Now, I just want to talk about Ali for a minute, who seemed to have a lovely idea for his pie, his apple and ginger with his pecan and walnut pastry. I'm sure that would have satisfied Mary's desire for a bit of extra different texture, you know, a bit of crunch in the pastry. But he said he really hated fruit pie and so was reluctant to taste it. I'm intrigued as to how you manage, because you guys must have all baked something at some point in the tent or maybe for another purpose that you don't actually like. So how do you make something and present it as something you're proud of when you don't actually like it?
Well, first of all, I eat anything and I don't I don't make anything I don't like. Like, so I can't really relate to that. You know, if I don't like a fruit pie, I figure out a way to make a fruit pie that I do like. You know, I don't really understand that. But I think you could sort of see they were setting him up for failure a bit when he described fruit pies as disgusting. And he said something like, I should probably taste it, but I don't want to. And I just thought, oh, that's like funny, but like that's really foolish. And obviously it came back to bite him on the bottom. But who doesn't like fruit? What's that about? Did he have some traumatic experience?
Yeah, I don't think he liked anything other than chocolate and...
What?
One of my mum's friends, she says that cooked fruit is the work of the devil.
Really?
So for some people, it's really, really not a thing. I don't know.
Does she eat jam? Jam's cooked fruit?
Yep. True. I know. I love cooked fruit. I love cooked, like stewed apple in a crumble or a pie is absolutely delicious. But yes, so Dan, what sort of thing, like let's say it was the apple, if you didn't like the sort of stewed down apple, you could have tried doing something like cherries, maybe a cherry pie.
There's always an option. Like as Howard used the dessert apple, which is a lot more firm, so it still has a lot of bite to it after it's finished. There's other things you can do. There are firmer fruits, there are softer fruits. I just don't understand. I mean, I get what you're saying, that some people just don't like certain things, but I just can't relate to that. I'm like, if there's something I don't particularly like, I find the version of it I like the most. I don't really understand that point of view. I just don't really relate to it.
No, I can understand if it was a fish pie. You know, and I really hate fish, and you've got to do a fish pie because some people really hate fish. But there's nothing that offensive about the flavour of fruit. It might be the cooked texture of fruit. You might not like the texture of it too much. And I totally go with you, Dan. You can change your fruit for texture and whatever. But there's nothing offensive about the flavour of fruit, I don't think, cooked. And he only has to have a little taste. It's not something he has to eat a whole mountain of it.
You could have at least tasted some of the juices to see if the ginger's coming through.
Because it was, I think he said he was going on smell, wasn't he? That he could smell there wasn't a lot of ginger in it. So I'll try a bit more.
Yeah. So there's probably not enough. I'll put some more in then.
I genuinely wondered if he was sort of going for a funny soundbite or something, like, because it just to be like, oh, I'm not even going to taste it. I'm like, that's really not a sensible decision to not taste your own food.
I even eat raw pastry. I taste my raw pastry just to make sure. Yeah. If it tastes good when it's raw, it tastes fine when it's cooked, doesn't it?
Jane, I've just checked. I have dug out the original recipe request, and it does say that the pastry top should cover at least 90% of the... So you could possibly have done a lattice, but yeah.
Yeah, you could have done a lattice, but it would have been a close weave lattice and not an open weave lattice.
I liked your cinnamon stick hole, by the way. I thought that was rather fun.
Yeah, Mary liked that.
I liked it too. I've got love the cinnamon stick. Yeah, exclamation mark. I did too. I really like Francis's. I like the idea of Francis as well.
With the frangipan, so that definitely would have helped.
That was a really good idea. And they called it very, very bland and dry.
I guess it's just that a peach is not the strongest flavour, especially if the peaches aren't very fresh and in season, or get them out of a can, then they're fresh and in season. You know, they can be a little bit bland, so I get that. The ones that I like the most, just because of the story, not even because of the pie or anything else, it was Becker's, and it was a rhubarb pie, and said that the only way that they got them to eat it as a kid by saying it was it cherry apple?
Yeah.
Cherry apple.
I love that because that's such a real story. You can imagine a mum doing that.
It is, but when you've heard it for about the 20th time, when you've been on the bench...
Wow, sorry. Cathy!
Ooh, Howard.
Well, just going back to the pastry for a bit, Christine was shown using a food processor, and then she got lots of lumps of butter in it. Is that a good way to make pastry, or do you guys prefer to use your hands so you can feel out all those lumps of butter?
I tend not to use my electrical equipment just because I really can't bother to wash it up. And it's a very good opportunity to put on sort of some video and merrily either knead or rub in butter. It's a good excuse to watch a bit of rubbish telly, really. But, you know, there's no excuse with the food processor. You just sort of blitz it and it does it in seconds. So I'm not quite sure why she had lumps. But, you know, rubbing in by hand, at least you can feel where the lumps are. But then all you have to do is put your hand in the food processor once it's been turned off and check to see whether it's all been incorporated properly. So perhaps Howard could throw some light on.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to, like you, Jane, just not bother getting the food processor out. And if I'm in a relaxed mood, it's quite nice to be able to do that. But I did think time is limited here. I will use food processor for this. It's like when we do classes or did an event yesterday and you're rubbing butter in and people are watching you and you think, this is really boring, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah, you're trying to do it really, really quickly and you can't.
Well, one thing I do think about rubbing the fat into flour is I actually think you get a slightly better result. Obviously, it's the slower version, and as you say, Howard, maybe not the most interesting thing to be doing, but I like, you know, listen to a bit of music or whatever at the time. But one of the things that I was introduced to embarrassingly late in my baking life was the idea that rather than getting the fat to disappear completely, you want to break it up into tiny little flat shards. And if you do it between your fingers, you end up with little flat splinters of it, and that sort of creates little micro layers in your pastry, and you end up with a bit more flake. If you just absolutely obliterate it with a machine, then you don't necessarily get sort of quite as much flake. The reward for all the hard work is maybe not immense, but I do think you get a better result, and I find it quite therapeutic doing things by hand. You know, for me, it's like, you know, when you go to yoga and do sun salutations for the 100 millionth time, you just sort of slip into a meditative state and you can just do it while, you know, clearing your mind. And, you know, it's quite relaxing, I find. But I understand that, you know, we've got busy lives and maybe other people would prefer to just chuck it in a blender. I get it.
What about those pastry maker things? Sarah loves these pastry maker things. Very often mine. People in classes have them.
The cutter thing.
Yes. Has anybody tried one of those? Sarah loves them.
I just find you get the same effect, but it's not as wearing on your hands. I just get very, very tired doing it like that. I just find it doesn't really work for me. So you get the best of both. You get the flakes of butter and you can still see it. You're still part of the process. You're just not having to use your arms quite so much.
And you can answer the phone because you haven't got dirty hands. That's
exactly.
The thing.
Yeah. I can put it down and run to the phone.
I did buy one years ago, but I think maybe the first time I used it on a big lump of very cold butter and bent the cutters on it. So I think it went in the drawer and never came out again.
I think you're supposed to still cube your butter before you use it.
All right. Maybe that's where I went wrong. Yeah, I think just attacking a very large block of very cold butter, that was probably my mistake.
I did that with a potato ricer. I bent the blade on a potato ricer by just putting something too big in it. Yes, I was not impressed. That went in the drawer and never came out again.
Well, we are on episode 4, as we know, and I think this is the first time that we have heard everything that everybody is making. We heard everything that Becca, Christine, Francis, everybody got a look in right at the beginning. So, Howard, does this mean I can enjoy the little history segments now?
You've still got a bit of me taking cakes into work, haven't you?
Yes, we did get another section of your life, Howard. I feel like we need a TV series of just your life, Howard, with your, you know, your fake office set and your running and your painting.
I thought we got a much better, actually, better understanding of what people were baking, certainly in the signature. I thought it was, when it came to the showstopper, we lost a little bit again. I thought we had less detail. You wouldn't really know what was in my fresh fig and feta phyllo flan apart from figs and feta, would you?
Fresh fig and feta.
Fig and feta by any chance? I'm glad we got to see a bit more of you, but I noticed we got to see Ruby again, yeah. And she was still sat on the floor studying out of a book. I was like, didn't we see this last week? I think that's all she does is study. So,
well, yeah. She's a very diligent student, or was, clearly, I assume.
Clearly.
But I was very pleased that we got quite a lot of, oh, no, from Howard again.
I didn't even notice.
We certainly got it in the technical, because I've actually written it down. Oh, no.
Oh, yes, we shall come on to the tricky technical in a moment. Good results-ish?
No.
In the signature?
No.
No results. No, terrible.
I thought we'd done terrible, all of us did in that, I must admit. But looking at it, I think Kimberly did really well, didn't she?
Yeah, she had a good week, didn't she? I liked the idea of the sour cherry in there. I think that would have just cut through the sweetness of the marzipan. I like the idea of rubies a lot, actually.
She seemed quite pleased with herself when she figured out the sour cherry thing. And I think, yeah, that sounded like a really nice compliment to the other flavours. I think Rob did okay as well, though, didn't he? The apple and pear pie?
He did. I think he was doing well up until that point. Well, and on the technical as we get to that. But yeah.
You're in a catty mood today, Howard. That's my job.
No, that was honestly, that was said without any cattiness. That was just me being objective there.
Sorry, I'm tainting you with my own brush. Sorry, Howard.
A rather tricky signature to start off with. Well, let's go to our technical challenge. And we had 12 individual custard tarts to make with 2 hours again for this. And I think it's safe to say that this also seemed very, very tricky as well. The biggest thing seemed to be not being able to get them out of the tin. Now, Jane, as soon as I saw people with the two little strips, I thought Jane would be proud. Because if anybody's been to a Bakewell tart class with Jane, you'll know that lining the muffin tins with those two little strips of paper are very, very useful. Yeah, Howard, what happened in this challenge?
Oh, gosh. I think I said at one point, I don't think it was actually broadcast, was it? Where it said, oh, yes, I've made custard tarts before. But when I've done them, again, I've blind baked them a bit. You know, because you want that you don't actually want a completely solid piece of pastry that's been blind baked. You still want a little bit of softness because you want the custard to adhere a little bit to the surface of the pastry. But boy, trying to do these without blind baking, I think was a bit of a nightmare. And what really infuriated us, I have to say, this is, I'm just offloading.
Go on, Howard.
This
was one of the series where at the end of the episodes, after they've shown the final, they then had Paul and Mary's masterclasses, and it was, they did Paul's custard tarts as part of this. And he said, you must let it get completely cold before you try and take it out of the tin. And I'm thinking, yeah, but we couldn't do that, could we? And we were all so furious at this kind of masterclass afterwards. But
I don't blame you. I have to say, 2 hours, again, not enough time. Clearly not enough time. I don't know who came up with that. But my favourite moment of the whole episode, and I'm sorry, apologies, Howard, but I was absolutely howling, was when you were levering out some pastry that was just like completely empty and broken and just put it on your presentation stand and you were just like, oh.
Oh, no.
But again, that is one of those things where because you're concentrating so much during the technical, you don't know what's happening. I just thought, I can't believe this. I can't get these last 2 hours at all. And I'm sort of, I literally had the tin upside down at one point, didn't I? I'm banging it on the bottom. Just get it out. And I put it on and sort of stopped and turned round. And you think, oh, thank goodness for that. Everybody's had the same problems.
I must admit, I really didn't enjoy watching people with really sharp knives running them around the inside of tins. No. I could just hear the scratching of metals and the piercing of pastry.
One that impressed me, and she's had a bit of a rough ride so far, old Frances, hasn't she? She warmed her custard. I think it's Raymond Blanc's lemon tart recipe, which is excellent, by the way. He raises the temperature of so you don't cook it as a custard, so you don't want it thick before you put it in, but you raise the temperature. And it just really helps with the setting in the time. And it's clearly worked out for Frances this time because she came first and hers looked really good, didn't it? So for anybody doing a custard-based tart, whether you blind bake or not, it's a really good idea just to raise that temperature so it doesn't go into the pastry case stone cold. If you think about how long it would take to raise all the temperature of all those ingredients once you put it in the oven, it doesn't actually probably start cooking for a good 20 minutes, I wouldn't have thought. Going back to what Howard said and Paul's masterclass, I did look up his recipe because I thought, I'm going to give them a go. except it wanted something like 7 eggs, and I didn't have 7 eggs, so I didn't make them. But it does say in his recipe on the BBC website, cool in the tin for 30 minutes.
Yeah, not surprised. If I was there, I think I'd have been having an absolute meltdown this week, to be honest. I thought it was, how was this not pastry week? Do you know what I mean?
Because it's a,
I think
pies and tarts.
This is the kind of halcyon days before kind of dairy week and Mexican week and things like that, where they just thought we need to kind of rework the basics a little bit. So we did get a French week, but yeah, it was basically the basics, wasn't it?
It was pastry week one and then pastry week two, I think. Yes. Yeah.
Well, we had two bread weeks as well. We had bread week and then sweet dough week, which...
Sweet dough week.
Oh, yeah, the sweet dough week. But, you know, maybe they'll do that this year because they made an announcement, didn't they, a month or so ago, saying they were going to go back to basics because everybody thought the competition was getting a bit too complicated. So maybe we'll have pies and tarts and pastry this year as well.
Yeah, maybe.
Instead of Tudor week or dinosaur week or something.
I still think we should go back to Howard's idea of poison week.
Oh, poison week! Oh, yes. Oh, yes. If that sounds a bit of a shock to anybody, please go back and listen to our previous series where we do talk about poison week. Well, I just want to bring up something that Rob said in the recipe. He said, it said nutmeg to taste. That seems very misleading to say to taste, giving, as he rightly pointed out, it's not his taste that he's satisfying. And we've seen this before, I think last year, when they did the tacos in the tent and they had to make a guacamole and a salsa. And I think Sandro was criticised for putting too much onions or too much chili in his salsa. And it's like, well, if you've not provided any guidelines for that, then you can't really criticise them because that's a personal taste.
What was it that you were... Paul had an issue with a gherkin or something as well.
Yeah.
That's not a euphemism, by the way.
No, actual gherkin.
Yes, he said he didn't like gherkins and didn't want gherkins in thing. Well, you know, we're going back to Ali tasting his fruit, aren't we? You're a judge. You've got to taste everything and be objective. For goodness sake, I think we had a right old go at that a couple of years ago.
I think you do have to be mindful in certain ways. You know, I think I was just mindful of the fact that the judges would be tasting a bunch of different things. So if it didn't have a good, strong flavour, it wouldn't wow them against the flavour of other things. So I was conscious to flavour things on the top side rather than having things more subtle. But you can't, you know, you can't please everyone with everything that you make because, you know, people have different points of view. But hopefully the judges are not too partial and make allowances for taste, maybe.
Can I just say, when they were sitting in the tent and they were the most beautiful custard tarts that Mary and Paul were tasting, yes, weren't they? Paul said, you know, it just has to have a bit of a wobble. And he got this tart and he was shaking it for all it was worth, just trying to get a little bit of a wobble on it. And there was no wobble on that tart, was there at all? Just made me laugh. Just shake it for all you're worth, actually. To fling it across the room, it might wobble a bit.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture. So our technical challenge rankings then, Glenn, bless him, came all the way down at the bottom in 9th position. And I think his comment were just major issues. And we didn't see any more of his major issues, but there we go. Ali came 8th. Christine was 7th. Ruby was 6th. Howard, middle of the pack at 5th. You're safe, Howard. Excellent.
God, Howard, how were you 5th?
Okay, so I think they took into account that there were sort of 10 and 2 halves, maybe.
Yeah.
They were all right. They were a little bit small, but actually the pastry was good and the custard was good. So I think that
it's
was...
well-baked and good colour. So yes, I think you've got some good comments there, definitely. Kimberly, 4th. So again, she's having a good week. Just about done, but a bit shallow and still quite raw pastry. So maybe not too good there. Rob, 3rd. Becca was 2nd. And Frances was 1st. She had a pretty good pastry, a good bake, and a good set on her custard, so not too much of a wobble. Now, if you like the sound of these delicious egg custard tarts, we will be doing some egg custard tarts for our next bake-along. This is our fourth week in the bake-along, and we are going to be making some egg custard tarts and a big Yorkshire curd tart as well. Very, very nice Yorkshire delicacy, if anybody wants to try that. That's going to be our class with Karen on the 26th of March. That's Sunday the 26th of March, and that's going to be at 5 o'clock UK time. So we hope some of you will join us for that. We've had a lot of fun so far. We've made an angel food cake with Jane. We've made Howard's beautiful decorative loaf and breadsticks, and we've made Howard's gorgeous chocolate petit fours. So please do come and join us for Karen's egg custard and Yorkshire curd tarts on Sunday the 26th of March. Thank you to all our listeners who have written in with questions for us. We've had them flooding in over the last couple of weeks, and we are very excited to be reading a few out. So we have a question here from Yoni in Brooklyn in New York, and she says, we've heard before on various media outlets and even from our bake-off hosts that the technical is the least weighted challenge for any given week. That is, it has the least effect on whether you stay or go home. This strikes me as completely off. To my eyes, the best judge of whether you're a good baker isn't adhering to a recipe you've already put together and tested before, but rather given X ingredients and Y time and Z heat, can you make something tasty and good looking using practiced baking skills. I was wondering your thoughts on this idea and the relationship of the technical in general to the other components of each week.
Can I jump in first and just say, I think that when we say that we feel the technical is least weighted, I think like we judge that by what we see. We assume that it's the least weighted. I was never told how things were weighted on the show. We have an assumption based on what we've seen that the showstopper is worth the most, but they never really spell it out for us. So I don't know. I agree with you in principle that the technical should matter a lot, but I think we see a lot more people's personalities and their individual baking styles in the signature and the showstopper. So I understand why those are shown a little bit more, but I do personally feel that the technical should matter more. I mean, that's my opinion, but then I'm quite a technical baker who focuses on the technique. So maybe that's just because it serves me. What do you think, Howard?
I think you're right. And I think the other thing is that the technical will change from week to week, won't it, in terms of the rankings. So you could have a week when everybody does brilliantly, and then it's so subtle, the difference between first and eighth or whatever. Another week where it's very, very clear the difference between those rankings. I think, as Jane said before, it's really about doing better than others, isn't it, really?
I agree with both of you. And I think the technicals, again, we have no idea, or I have no idea how it's ranked. So whoever says that they do know, I am not sure that they do, to be honest, because I think the production company keep the deep, dark secrets deep and dark and secret. And I know we're still all covered up under our NDAs, but they don't tell us some of this stuff, and they certainly haven't told us my year anything about how it's ranked. So, you know, whoever says they do know, I would question whether they do. As far as the technical is concerned, I think with the showstopper and the signature, you have a chance to look it up if you've never heard of it. So I'd never made a mirror glaze cake. I then looked it up to find out what it was, and then I practiced it. With the technical, you can be faced with things that you've never heard of, thump and noodle being one of them, which is still strikes terror in my heart in the middle of the night. And you have to use your skills as a baker to decipher the recipe, sometimes with very scant information. You may not have any idea what they look like, how long they bake for, and you just have to use the skills that you've got in order to try and find a way through the puzzle of the technical challenge. But yes, everybody knows what a Viennese whirl looks like, but not everybody knows what a marjolaine, or however you pronounce it, looks like, which is what we had. So I think technical challenge is very important. I think it's something you've never tried before most of the time, and you have no idea what it looks like most of the time, how long it should bake for. And it shows up the skills of you as a natural baker, I think, or an experienced baker. So I do think it ought to be highly marked, But whether it is or not, I have no idea.
Just picking up on the way the question was worded as well, it's not like what Ready, Steady, Cook, is it? Where you sort of take the ingredients and you're producing something delicious from that. The technical is also about producing what they are looking for. So you may do something and shape it completely wrongly because in your ignorance you don't know what it looks like, and therefore you will be ranked lower down the kind of pecking order. But actually it might taste okay. So it's a combination of those. It's not only about, you know, your skill as a baker and your ability to use those ingredients, it's actually producing the thing that they are looking for.
Chocolate feathering last year being one of them. Yes. Actually, the most beautiful chocolate feathers, didn't they?
Oh, they were stunning. They were Shabir stunning. Especially. Yes.
And sometimes I feel like the physical mistakes are ranked more severely than the baking mistakes. I remember in my season, we had to make mamoul, these Middle Eastern pastries, and Karen put the wrong filling in the wrong shape, which is like, in my mind, a fairly minor error. And she was bottom of the pack. And yet above her was Terry, who made the pastry completely wrong and the whole thing had melted and fallen off. And to me, the sort of inedible disaster pastry should have been at the bottom and the simple physical mistake should have been higher up. So it's just different how things are weighted sometimes. And I don't know how to feel about that. So sometimes we always question the judging, don't we? We often look at the judging and think, I'm not sure about that. But yeah, especially in the technical, sometimes I'm a little confused.
Well, thank you, Yoni, for that question. Provoked a lovely debate there and brought up some very good points. So thank you very much. We have another question here from Cindy in Kansas. And Cindy says, I'd like to ask you wonderful bakers if anyone ever forgets and licks their fingers while in the tent. I'm not admitting to anything here, says Cindy. And she says, thank you for a wonderful podcast and I'm really enjoying the retro series. So thank you, Cindy, for those lovely words. So yes, do you, any of you, lick your fingers in the tent when you've been told not to?
We were told specifically not to, but, you know, we do it automatically, don't we? I lick my fingers at home. Actually, I'll let you into a secret. Sometimes before something's going to go in the oven, it is going to be baked. I lick a spoon and maybe put it back into the mixture again. Oh, yeah, there you go. That's disgusting, isn't it? But I kind of think if it's, I know, don't come around to my house, meat, and my neighbours, if you're listening, they will
talk
be
about
baked
poison
first.
Week.
I know. Yes, you just have to be a bit careful that you don't use some of your disgusting habits at home in the tent on camera. If anybody who eats my bakes listening, I'm very sorry. But it's a bit like you said about Manon blowing on things.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You just do things automatically and then you hope that they don't catch you.
So one of the things I do all the time when I'm piping is I will clean off the end of the piping bag with my finger and then lick my finger. And then sometimes I think, how many times have I done that with the same finger? And it's been in and out of my mouth and I'm wiping it back on the piping bag. And I'm like, I'm not sure that this food is sanitary anymore. So I do have to be mindful that actually all of us often work, do the classes on camera. And it's a similar vibe. You sort of remember that people are looking at you. So I usually remember not to do anything too gross when I know that people are watching me. When I'm at home in the kitchen by myself. Ooh.
Privacy in your own kitchen.
Oh, Dan, let's not pretend you don't just stick whisks in your mouth during classes. Let's not
sometimes
pretend.
Sometimes. Go on, Howard, what about you?
Maybe.
Well, I was shocked, actually, I must admit, because I don't think that I lick my fingers. But then that little shot of me taking cakes into work, I give someone a slice of cake and then lick my fingers after it. It's like, I can't believe I do that. So.
Well, thank you, Cindy, for that. I think exposing that we all sometimes do things that maybe we shouldn't, and that's okay. So please do keep your questions coming in, everybody. You can send them to us via social media. We are at Bake With A Legend on all platforms, or you can email us thebakedown@bakewithalegend.com. So now we move into our Showstopper Challenge, which this week, it was a phyllo pastry pie. Now, we had 4 hours to do this, and it could have been free form or in a tin. And Howard, I think straight away we have to come to you with the drama that your pie created with you, Mel and Sue, you know, spatulating it out of the tin and Becker and Glenn in the background.
Yeah.
Was it as dramatic as it looked?
It was dramatic because I thought, you've got to bear in mind, I've not had a good run up until now, have I? In terms of accident,
well,
a bit accident prone. So you think this is one of those things where it's probably going to collapse, isn't it? It was such a relief to actually get it on that plate. What had happened was that when I'd practiced this at home, part of the way through baking, I just tipped it out and put it on a flat baking tray. So once it had crisped up enough, I'd kind of unmoulded it and then sort of put it onto a flat baking tray, which made it a lot easier. But I didn't have one of the lovely crispy Neff ovens that they have in the tin. And it had clearly crisped up so much in the tin, it wasn't going to survive being upturned in order to get it out. So that was the only thing we could work out, only way we could work out doing it, really.
But I'm confused. So the attractive part of the tin was on the bottom. Was that the part that had a pattern?
Yes, yeah. So I was using it essentially as like a ring mould pie tin, right, rather than as you would normally use it as a
bun tin, yeah.
Yes.
But did you then flip it over to show the attractive pattern on top? Is that what happened or not?
No, that stayed underneath because it was basically like an open top pie baked in a ring. So the tin was lined with the phyllo pastry, filling goes in, it's baked, and then you unspring it so the sides of the tin and the centre come out.
But why didn't you use a flat-bottomed tin rather than a patterned bottom tin? Would that have made life easier?
I couldn't get one big enough at the time. I think that was... It had to be a certain size. The only... It wasn't particularly patterned on the bottom. It was a flat bottom, I think. It was fluted round the sides, but I think it was. I'll have to dig it out, but I'm pretty sure it was flat on the bottom. I think it had two different bottoms that you could put on, a flat one or one that was kind of ridged, like if you were doing a kind of bunt or something like that.
So a pan with interchangeable bottoms. One for business and one for party. Sounds good.
Yeah. Have you not got interchangeable bottoms, Sarah?
I've just got a flat one.
I've got a dimpled one. I just thought Howard's looked really scrummy, actually, except we were talking earlier, weren't we, before we started recording about feta and whipped feta and did we like whipped feta? Which I made in a dip the other day, and I think you and I, Dan, like it in limited quantities, not necessarily a great bowl of it whipped. So I think I might not have chosen feta to go with fig.
But the spanakopita, I mean, lots of people did that or did a variation upon it. That's just spinach and feta, right?
It's spinach and feta, basically, and you put other stuff in with it, don't you? Yeah, which I, again, find the feta too... I'm not a mad feta fan, I think. I think maybe it's not my most favourite cheese.
But I thought the spanakopita was the easy choice, or the obvious choice, rather. So I kind of liked that people who went for other things, and maybe people who went to more towards the sweet end of the spectrum, because maybe that's what I preferred. And I particularly liked, even though it didn't work out very well for him, Ali's mahancha or snake cake. I really like the idea of a snake cake. Do you know what? I would have dreaded this whole week, actually. If this had been my week, I'd have seen the brief. I'd have been absolutely beside myself, not looking forward to this. The variation in all of the phyllo, I thought, was not unsurprising. Howard, what persuaded you to do it in smaller pieces rather than the big one? Did you just think it was...
Partly lack of confidence. I just thought I've never done... I have now done... strudel and phyllo and stretch it out, and I don't mind doing that at all. But I just thought, I can manage this. I can do it in smaller sheets and keep building it up and lining it. And as I say, it probably took me about 2 hours that way. But it was. I loved this challenge.
Really?
I just thought, yes! Oh, I loved it so much. I just thought, I can do this. I can... It's manageable within 4 hours. If I spend kind of two on the pastry, I've got enough time to do something a bit arty with the bits and cut them and sort of roll them up so we've got a bit of texture around the top and put the filling in and what have you. And I think I've mentioned this on classes before. Although it looked as if we were lifting that flan out at the last minute. Actually, I made like a tahini dressing and so on to go on over the top afterwards. So it wasn't quite as rushed as the editing made it look.
Well, you got very good comments on yours, didn't you? Flavours complementing each other. It looked very elegant. So, yeah. Well, it clearly worked out for you. I think maybe this you're just misremembering it, going back, thinking, because you had a good result. You're probably looking back on it with rose-tinted glasses, I think, Howard. I think it was an awful challenge.
You used 00 pasta flour, and I'd never have thought to do that.
I tried it with a few things. I tried it with ordinary plain flour and with a strong white flour. And the 00 was giving me a better kind of stretch so it was allowing me to get a little bit thinner, I thought. But
what did you think? Now, so when we were in the tent, we were not allowed to use other empty benches. And the only time we were allowed to use an empty bench was in the final, because we had so many items. But Ali used an empty bench for all his stretching out, didn't he? It was Ali. And then Kimberly came along and asked if she could use part of the bench. And she looked a little bit put out that Ali had taken up the whole bench. Do to spill the beans on that one, Howard, or were you...
Well, I didn't know that had happened until you see the programme broadcast. But yeah, I thought, okay, it's all right, people stretching it, but... They were having to do that on their own benches, weren't they? I think Glenn was stretching his on his own.
And some benches have a sink on the end, yes, so you would be limited also by the amount of space.
So all of ours did on our season. During, I think it was week 4 of my season, there was an empty bench behind me and I put some baking sheets on there just to put them out of the way. And I got yelled at and told I wasn't allowed to use it because it was unfair to other bakers who had to just make use of the space they had. So I'm surprised he got away with that. But then if you're doing a big phyllo sheet, it does kind of, you do need all that space, don't you? Maybe, I don't know. Did Kimberly have a thing?
I just wonder if maybe this was an exception to the rule this week.
Maybe. I mean, she cleared off the judges' table and used that, Kimberly did. And I've never seen anyone do that before. So, they obviously, it would be unthinkable that somebody would do that on my season. I guess she got special permission to use it. She wouldn't have just been bold enough to walk over there and use it without permission, I'm sure.
Oh, she would. Yay.
Would she?
Yay.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I just thought you don't often see tension in the tent. There's been a bit of tension in your series, what with Custard Gate and now Bench Gate.
Bench Gate.
We're making a new scandal, everybody.
Yeah, we are.
Well, we had some really nice flavours in the tent. We had everything from sort of orange and cardamom and date and pistachios with Ali's beautiful Mahansha. And Ruby went sweet as well with rose, almond and raspberry, which had very, very good comments. I don't think we got too much information about Becca's Moroccan vegetable phyllo. I think that was the only one that we didn't actually get introduced to with the lovely Tom Hovey illustrations. But we had a big range of flavours here. Kimberly's definitely coming out really well, which I think looked beautiful with the little extra bit of crackling she put round the top. I think Mary said it was ready for a party, and it really did look beautiful, I thought.
It definitely looked great. And for me, I was honestly, I mean, I'm a simple man, but I was just sold on chicken and bacon. I was like, yeah, I'll have that one. But it's like that's my go-to protein is chicken and bacon for everything. So when she was like, it's a chicken and bacon pie, I was like, sold. I'll have that one, please.
I like the idea of putting the turmeric in the pastry as well to make it slightly more interesting colour. I thought it was definitely my favourite. And I'm like you, chicken and bacon every time. It was described as, apart from absolutely beautiful, an explosion in the mouth. But it did look great. It was the one. Actually, now, even though I've not long had my breakfast, I actually is making me feel quite hungry just to think of it. But that's because I don't like spanakopita pita very much. I'm not a huge feta fan.
Now, just going back to Poison Week, just makes me think of Rob's comments about his big selection of mushrooms. I love the moment where he just sort of looked into the camera and said, "If you eat the wrong ones, there's no cure. You could just dissolve." Yeah.
Okay. It was quite dark.
It was an interesting one, though, that, wasn't it? Because I did wonder, is that one of those occasions where you could have said, I want these mushrooms preparing beforehand, kind of cleaning
up? Yes, he said he spent so much time washing them, didn't he?
Cleaning mushrooms is
You shouldn't
awful.
Wash mushrooms. No, you should not wash mushrooms. Wipe you should them. Only wipe them. Yeah.
It's a tedious job, cleaning mushrooms. And annoyingly, sometimes you'll get them, and especially if you get your shopping delivered, as I do, because I'm super lazy, you'll get, sometimes the packets will have no mud on them at all and barely needs a wipe, and sometimes they're absolutely filthy. And those looked very dirty, so I'm not surprised they took him half an hour to clean. That's why I often don't bother with the faff of that. I have to say, if I'm making, in the winter, I often make stews, and if I want mushrooms to go in the stews, I'll often just buy a tin of quartered mushrooms, because it saves an awful lot of time.
But he could have brought his own mushrooms from the supermarket. We could bring our own ingredients along and tell them that we were. And had he brought his own ingredients along, he could have prepared them at home beforehand.
That is true, yes.
I liked the way they were talking about the Mushroom Club, and he said it was an opportunity to kill yourself. Which is awful, isn't it, really? You wouldn't catch me tasting a stray mushroom unless it's from the supermarket. I was too scared.
I just now have visions of Rob and Ian Cumming just sort of going through the forest, finding like roadkill and mushrooms and sort of scavenging through the countryside.
Oh, I'm not going to dinner there either, really.
Sounds like a new Channel 4 programme. Yeah.
So what other flavours do we think stood out? I think we need to talk about Francis's.
Yes, I was about to say.
Beautiful. I mean, it looked beautiful. The design was lovely. Again, we had the orange and lemon. I think orange blossom, ricotta. It sounded really, really beautiful. And with the cherries as well. And her comments were layers were too thick, and so some were undercooked in the middle. And of course, Paul loved to trot out his style over substance, which I think we had at least twice in the programme. Poor Francis. What do we think of that one?
I thought the flavour sounded lovely, but yeah, the execution was not great. And you could see how wet it was. Howard, when you saw how big that roll was, were you sort of, was your instant concern it was going to be all raw inside?
I think so. I think you sort of think, has somebody come up with a different way of cooking this to the way that I've been doing it? Because my idea was that you need to get those layers of phyllo, butter in between, but they need to be on the outside. So the idea of actually having layers of phyllo inside, I thought, I don't know how this is going to work. And clearly it didn't.
No. I thought the design of it was very pretty, but I think Paul was kind of dead on with the style of a substance. But it's a shame because the flavour sounded lovely. And my palate leans much more towards the sweet than the savoury. I like the sound of rubies. I liked the sound of Francis's. But yeah, it's just a shame that it also just the bulk of the pie, the main part of the phyllo pie, just looked like a sort of giant salami, didn't it? So it wasn't the most, the overall artistic vision was good, but there wasn't any beauty in the main phyllo part of the pie, I found. What did you think, Jane?
No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the overall impression was lovely. But I thought, oh, is that the same background that she used for her peach? James and the Giant Peach Pie the day before. I don't blame her for that. I thought the tree looked absolutely stunning. I loved the idea of it. But yes, the main part of the pie was just the trunk. It was just like a very dull looking log. You know, she could have actually added, if she'd been going for this very artistic look, the inside, I totally agree with you, but if she'd gone to the outside, she could have done something to make it look as though there was bark on it or something like that. So, yeah, you just have to look a little bit deeper with Frances. I love her creative ideas, but I'm not always sure that I like her bakes particularly. I thought there were some much nicer ones this time. I loved rubies. I like savoury. I love the look of Howard's, but could you have done it with brie or camembert instead of feta? But
there wasn't a lot of feta in there. It wasn't.
There wasn't there.
No,
just a
it was.
Bit.
It was mainly kind of bulgur wheat.
Where was it?
Yeah, lemon thyme and feta. So that was giving it? You the sort of solidity in which to then put the figs.
Bulgur wheat.
I'm not sure I noticed that it had bulgur wheat in it.
Some of your baking is awfully healthy sounding, Howard. It's sort of like you're trying to.
That's why he looks so fit. That and the running, of course.
That's why Howard is more trim than me, certainly. But yeah,
and me. But I like this. I like the sound of alleys, actually. Yeah. But I totally agree with Paul, and that's not a phrase I utter very often. That he put pistachios on the top, and there was none inside.
Oh, that
and
was I'm Mary, agree- wasn't it? I think.
Was it Mary?
Yeah. That's why you agreed with it.
Oh, maybe it
that's
was. Why. Yeah, oh, I agree with Mary as well. Maybe. Because I'm a great believer that whatever's inside, there should be a nod to it on the outside, especially if you're using nuts. If you think there's pistachios in it and then you cut inside and there are no pistachios, you're disappointed. Equally, if there are loads of nuts inside and you haven't had you might not like nuts or you might be allergic to nuts. There are no nuts on the outside. There's no visual clue that you shouldn't eat it. So I do think that if you're going to use something as a decoration, unless it's a bit of icing sugar.
Yeah.
You really ought to have some of that on the inside.
The decoration should tell you what's in it.
Yeah, in a way, yes, unless you're doing a cake with lots of flowers on it or something. But
there's mixed messages.
Yeah, I think the decoration should give you a hint in these sorts of bakes.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Well, Christine's, I think, also looked really nice. She had a roasted vegetable phyllo pie with, sorry, Jane, feta cheese. I don't think we were told the amount of all the different vegetables, but we got a shot of them on her bench, didn't we? And there looked to be all sorts of things. I mean, I think aubergine, there was some, I don't know if it was chilies or peppers, but all sorts of lovely vegetables. And she got some beautiful comments on that, didn't she? Stunning flavours and a good bake. So I think Christine wasn't having the best week so far, bless her. She was feeling the pressure in the first day, but the phyllo pie, I definitely think, brought her up a bit. I think Glenn's did as well. Glenn was sort of hovering down the other end, and his phyllo pie did seem to save him as well. His spanakopita with feta, spinach and walnuts. And the comments were good layers, crisp, well-cooked, and the spinach really came through. On that note, let's move on to our eliminations and our star bakers. So this week, our star baker was the lovely Kimberly. She had a really nice pecan, rosemary and caramel apple pie in the signature. She did very well in the technical, coming fourth. And in the showstopper, she made a beautiful chicken bacon butternut squash pie with the lovely turmeric pastry. And she had very, very good comments. So do we think a well-deserved star baker for Kimberly there?
Yeah, you could have picked her easily. It all delicious. She did very well.
I have to say, I was very happy for Kimberly. And I sorry, present company, Howard, but on that season, Kimberly, when I watched it live, Kimberly was my favourite baker. So was she. Yeah. Because I loved how confident she was and how interesting her flavour was, and she had great technique. So I loved Kimberly and I wanted Kimberly to win. Sorry, Howard.
That's fine. We all looked up to Kimberly. We you know, she would try and calm us down, and we'd do exercises to try and chill out and so on. But
she seemed lovely, yeah. I must admit.
But it never worked. Just...
Too much stress in the tent.
Yeah.
And as every week, we do have to say goodbye to somebody. And unfortunately, this week it was Ali. He did not have the best pastry in his signature, and you know, him not being able, well, not wanting to taste his pie really put him at a disadvantage there. He came eighth out of nine in the technical, and I mean, his showstopper didn't appear too bad, but
it wasn't bad.
It seemed to be like he didn't do quite enough to save himself, maybe, rather than actually doing a bad showstopper.
Apart from rolling out all the phyllo, there wasn't actually a lot of work in it. That was the main bulk of the work. Then it was just sort of rolling it up and coiling it up, you know. So maybe that's why. I don't know, but then other people did similar amounts of work. But one of the things that I thought was really lovely about Ali's departure was how upset people were about it, and people obviously really liked Ali a lot, and I will single out our dear friend Howard here for promptly bursting into tears. So
yes, that was very sweet. That was so sweet.
Did you really
Howard?
Like Ali?
I did like Ali, and it was so sad because we'd obviously on the journey back we tended to go back on the train together. So I remember that last journey back with him was awful because he you know, he was getting off in Birmingham and I was going on to Sheffield. But Oh, just the thought that he wasn't going to be there again. It was awful.
Oh, and poor Christine. She said, if you don't stay in touch, I'll kill you. Bless her. She's so, so sweet. Oh, so we end on a bit of a sad note as we say goodbye to Ali, who's clearly a very loved presence in the tent. But on happier notes, we hope we will see you all very soon at another class. As we've said before, we do have our lovely Bake Along series, which is going really well. We're very much looking forward to the rest of it. And we have our Egg Custard Tarts with Karen on the 26th of March. And we have some lovely bakes from Dan coming up, as well as Ian, Rosie, and another one from Howard and Jane as well. So we're very much looking forward to all of those. And don't forget, when you are signing up for our classes, you can use the code PODCAST to get 10% off your next booking. Jane, Howard and Dan, thank you very much for joining us for episode 4. We will be back next week with our biscuits and tray bakes week.
Just heard a Stripped Media production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.